Check, check, 1, 2. Davey D hanging out with you this afternoon. We are here in New Orleans at the International Hurricane Katrina and Rita Tribunal. We're talking to one of the prosecutors, King Downing. He's with the ACLU. First of all, what has it been like, this tribunal?
Well, first, let me give props to you, Davey D, for coming down here and covering this. And I've been following your site for a long time, and you've kept it resourceful and insightful, and you're reaching out to the people I'm trying to reach out to.
Well, we appreciate that.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the thing was, you know, being here, participating in a tribunal, what has that been like for you?
For me, it's been, on one side of it, it's been a real high because people have come together to do something about this. And as I said in my statement, the Declaration of Independence says when the government doesn't do what it's supposed to do, the people need to do what they need to do. And so this is saying the courts aren't giving us justice, so we're going to create our own justice and make our own record. We don't need them to do it. So that's been the high. The low has been that after all this time, the people here have been treated just like any other third world people anywhere else, just as refugees and people that are just being completely ignored.
Now, you know, one of the hot topics that you served as a prosecutor on was police brutality. The case around Ramel Madison and the massacre on the Dassinger Bridge, and then the other brother from Oakland, you know, where we're at. I forget his first name, but William Tanner, who's the Army's veteran of all people. What haven't we heard that probably needs to come out there? I mean, you had to research this case and really have a lot of evidence. What can you kind of, you know, give us a little bit closer view of this?
Well, I think really the main thing what we haven't heard is really what the families went through behind this. That's the one thing that you don't always get to bring out in these cases. We got all the facts about how basically the police wilded out when this Good Samaritan, who had given a jump start to the police. Now, how many people in our community would pull up and give a squad car a jump?
So you're talking about William Tanner.
Yeah, about William Tanner. So what we're saying is that we don't usually get to talk about is that his family and he have been traumatized by this. And I met the Rommel family and the two sisters who were all part of that. All of them were devastated by their brother being killed like this, their other brother being arrested, and then having the last brother really taken on the responsibility to bring in his own medical examiners and take all the resources the family had, $400,000 bail for his brother, all of that they all went through, and to be left with nothing.
Do they have lawsuits outside of this tribunal that are pending, and what are the chances of that?
Well, the Madison family does have a lawsuit, and the lawsuit is on behalf of the parents because under this system, brothers and sisters don't get any rights for the loss of a sibling.
Whoa. So you can kill my sister and I have no rights?
If you kill your sister, this court doesn't recognize any loss to you. It only recognizes the loss of children for parents and the loss of parents for children.
Wow. You know, one of the things that's been very interesting was seeing the amount of support that the police have given to the people who are accused of first-degree murder. In this case, shooting the brother, Ramel Madison, I guess his name was Ronald, and also for the family that was on the bridge, which they were witness to, which is why they got shot in the first place. Are you shocked that New Orleans PD would be this way? And how does this happen when you have so many black officers on these streets in the force, police chief black, mayor black? How does this happen here?
This is no surprise at all. In city after city, when we've had police brutality cases, the police come out in full effect for officers, even though I would be surprised with all the inside. They have their own snitching that goes on with them, that they all know exactly what happened, and that they, for them to make this kind of show of force shows why we have a problem with them all over and why they really need to be just removed.
What do you think will happen?
Well, I think that the Madison family is probably going to have a strong case. I don't know if these officers are going to be convicted. I mean, history was already made by them being indicted, because from what I know, the last time an officer was indicted in this city for murder was an outside contract that he and another person committed against a private person behind a personal beef. but I don't know of one recently behind this. So I think that their case is probably going to get a big settlement, but I can't say after what we saw with Rodney King and some of these others that Abdul Wema and these others, that any of them are going to have any kind of justice behind bars, which is where they should be.
You know, you spoke outside of your role as prosecutor briefly and talked about, you know, as a member of the ACLU, that you advocate quite frequently on behalf of victims of police brutality. What sort of legislation is coming down the pipe? What sort of challenges or obstacles do you have, and who's the main obstacle, if there is one, to get any sort of legislation or policy changes that would improve our relationships with the police?
You want a LP. That's an LP answer for that one right there. But as far as legislation, the only legislation that's even coming down, and, you know, we always urge people to take that step too. I mean, we sometimes forget about that, but there's a bill that's out now called the End Racial Profiling Act, and that would ban racial profiling. Now, I know what people are going to say, well, banning is not going to stop them, but not doing anything about it is not going to stop them either. So the law would ban them from doing it. It would make them complete records on who they stop. And believe it or not, even when the police fill out the records, the records show that this is going on. The last thing it would do is it gives everybody a right to go into court for this. So that's the only legislation. Everything else about it has to be just people in the streets just saying, we're tired, we're not going to go for these civilian review boards anymore because they're not taking care of what needs to be done. What needs to happen is that there needs to be pressure. Every time they do this, they need to go through the system we go through, the criminal justice system, before a jury.
You know, there was a suggestion that we had made at the U.S. Social Forum when we did our conference on snitching, and that's something you've been involved with, or government informants. And, you know, the suggestion came out that maybe police should suffer criminal penalties if they don't snitch on the wrongdoings of fellow officers. If they are witness to a criminal act, we find out that they were in the vicinity, that they should be brought up on charges. Is that something that you all might be able to push to maybe, you know, eradicate some of the brutality, since it's supposed to only happen with a few bad apples and the blue wall of silence kicks in, hence the police, the original, you know, folks to walk around with a shirt that said, stop snitching?
Well, it might be a few bad apples, but those apples are hanging from a bad tree, because that tree is not able to do anything with the few bad apples. So as far as the stop snitching, I'm going to be all with stop snitching until the police start snitching. And they can't tell us anything about stop snitching until they start. Till we hear something from them, stop snitching is going straight ahead, because already it is a violation of the oath they took. It's a violation of their administrative rules, and it's also a violation of law, official misconduct, if they see a law being broken and they don't do anything to stop it.
Really? So that law is already in place?
Yeah, they're violating the law every time they see something going on and they don't do something about it.
How come that's never enforced?
Because, as there's an African saying, that in the court of chickens, the roach never gets justice. And you know who we are, and you know who they are. And until the roaches basically just, you know, move the chickens out, the system that has to watch itself, like Malcolm X said, the fox guarding the hen house, we're not going to see the police department or those who pay their salaries ever step in and eradicate this in a systematic way. They may knock these seven officers off, or two of them, or three of them, but they're never going to go after the commanders who said there's something fishy about this story, but we're just going to keep it quiet, and had it all the way get to the point that I believe it was the feds that came in or someone like that and began to put pressure on them to serve these other seven up if you want to save us from taking your whole institution down.
3, 2, 1. David D. hanging out with you this afternoon. We are here in New Orleans at the Hurricane Katrina and Rita International Tribunal. We're talking with King Downing of the ACLU. He's also the prosecutor of the case. If you have listened to our show, you heard him as the prosecutor with Ramel Madison, who is one of his clients that he brought up to testify about the horror of the police brutality. We're going to listen to the type of testimony that you brought out of William Tanner. What do you want us to pay close attention to as we listen to this conversation?
Well, the main thing to listen to about William Tanner is that he's the kind of person that that the government and the powers that be and even the so-called black middle class say they want to see. They want somebody who had went all the way through school, didn't have problems, went into the military, served in the military, and then comes out and shows a positive attitude towards police, which he did by helping the police. And I want people to pay attention to that and remember that. And he pulled over to help somebody who was shot and then turned around and got a beat down while in handcuffs and had his property stolen, had his car burnt with somebody inside the vehicle, someone told him, possibly as a result of him being the kind of person they want to see.
With him being a veteran, does there become a circling of the wagons, you know, with him being a veteran and maybe fellow Army officers and military personnel wanting to end police brutality because one of their own got beat and brutalized, or does that go out the window?
You know, that's a good question, because in this case, who knows if that was happening or not? I don't know if they knew he was a veteran, but I know at some point in time, unlike most of us, I don't have relatives, close people caught up in the police department. The reason why he got out, and I don't know if this is coming out in your tracking now, but the reason why he was let go was because one of the officers recognized him as the one that gave the officer the jump start the day before. Now, when the feds came to his house, Homeland Security, they came because he knew in his family there were other police. So they had the juice to get the feds to come in personally and sit down and hear his story. Now, he testified that he thought they were grilling him. Even though those connections brought the feds into the case, they were still grilling him like they thought he was guilty of something. When they finally realized he wasn't, they turned around and called right back and said, yeah, we know where your car is. Your car has been burnt up behind the police station.
Wow. What lesson should we glean from, you know, his testimony and some of the others that we might not have heard in New Orleans?
Well, the first thing is, it can happen to you any place, anytime. Just as sure as people are playing the lottery, thinking that they have a chance to win on long odds, the same thing as you could get a beatdown or get shot, or someone in your family could, under long odds. So people have to stop just looking at it and saying, that's too bad, because when it comes to your family, you're going to jump up, and I've had this happen. People who have let this go jump up and say, how come y'all ain't coming and rallying for me? How come you ain't doing nothing? But the thing is, where were you when Sean Bell got beat down? Where were you when Abner Louima got sodomized? And where were you when Amadou Diallo got shot, or all the people in your area? So if you wait till it happens to you or your family, it'll be too late.
Lastly, you know, of course you brought to light these two cases, but you submitted a bunch of evidence to show this pattern of neglect and abuse that takes place with the New Orleans Police Department. My final couple of questions before we listen to the testimony is, how widespread was this after Katrina? What makes New Orleans be this type of police department? What are some of the other cases that we haven't heard that could have easily been on that stand?
Well, New Orleans had a particularly corrupt history early on. That police department had been disbanded sometime in the 1800s. For corruption and bribery and other kinds of fraud. But I'm sorry to say that this department is not a whole lot different from other departments. And I'm sure there are people listening who will jump up and say, yeah, well, you're trying to say they're all bad. But, you know, when you line them all up, you know, from the best to the worst, you still have ongoing beatdowns, arrests, and racial profiling. And a lot of them, even the ones with civilian review boards, don't seem to be able to stop it. To me, if you're not stopping the problem and all you're doing is paying the victims, then you're not doing anything.
And we're not able to stop the problem because of the strength of the police unions. How do we deal with that? Especially since they use the word union, but it doesn't seem to be in sync with unions that, you know, that traditionally in liberal communities and democratic, you know, leaning enclaves, you know, seem to support.
Well, you know, I'm a pro-union person, and so if we're going to blame the unions, it would be like blaming the unions for businesses. The unions definitely are fighting tooth and nail things that happen in terms of workplace changes, but the commanders and the captains and the people who oversee them are the ones that are not making these changes, that are letting this stuff go, because they're the commanders. They're in charge. They have the ability now to take everybody in. They have the ability to question them. They have the ability to send snitches in the way they do in our community, snitches into those departments and undercover what's going on, and they have the ability to do what they do with us. They make an example of us all the time, especially in the hip-hop community. They're pulling people over and knowing that they're going to get some headlines and thinking that's going to affect everybody else. They don't do that with their officer. We're going to find one, we're going to make an example, and that way all the rest of them will stop profiling and beating people down.
That's real talk there. Well, we're going to listen to this testimony already in progress with William Tanner out of Oakland, but he lives in New Orleans, and pay close attention. We're out for now. Peace.